He can bend the word without breaking. He took a deep breath, then asserted, I believe it can be done. This word is not as pure and dangerous as might be. He turned to Covenant. But I fear for you, Ur-Lord. For me? Covenant reacted as if the High Lord had accused him of something. Why? I fear that the mere closeness of your ring to the word may undo it. So you must come last. And even then we may be caught within the catacombs, with no bridge to bear us out again. Last. He had a sudden vision of being forsaken or trapped here, blocked by that deep cleft from the escape he needed. He wanted to protest, let me go first. If I can make it, anybody can. But he saw the folly of that argument. Forbear, he urged himself. Keep the bargain. His fear made him sound bitter as he grated, get on with it. They're bound to send some new guards one of these days. Prothol nodded. With a last measuring look at Covenant, he turned away. He and Morum went up onto the bridge to engage the word. Tuvor and Terrell followed, carrying coils of Klingor, which they attached to the Lord's waists and anchored at the foot of the bridge. Thus secured against the collapse of the span, Prothol and Morum ascended cautiously until they were only an arm's length from the invisible word. There they knelt together and started their song. When the bottom of the word became visible in crimson, they placed their staffs parallel to it on the stone before them. Then, with tortuous care, they rolled their staffs directly under the iridescent power. For one bated moment, they remained still in an attitude of prayer as if beseeching their wood not to interrupt the current flowing past their faces. A heart-stopping flicker replied in the red shimmer. But the lords went on singing, and shortly the word steadied. Bracing themselves, they started the most difficult part of their task. They began lifting the inner ends of their staffs. With a quick intake of wonder and admiration, the company saw the lower edge of the word bend, leaving a low, tented gap below it. When the peak of the gap was more than a foot high, the lords froze. Instantly, Banner and two other Bloodguard dashed up the bridge, unrolling a rope as they ran. One by one, they crawled through the gap and took their end of the lifeline to safe ground beyond the span. As soon as Banner had attached his end of the rope, Morum took hold of Prothol's staff. The High Lord wormed through the gap, then held the staffs for Morum. By the time Morum had regained his position beside Prothol, old Birinair was there and ready to pass. Behind him, in rapid single file, went the yeoman, followed by Quan and Lythe. In turn, Tuvor and Terrell slipped under the word and anchored their ropes to the two lords beyond the chasm. Then, moving at a run, the last Bloodguard slapped the central lifeline around Covenant and made their way through the gap. He was left alone. In a cold sweat of anger and fear, he started up the bridge. He felt the two pillars of rock light as if they were scrutinizing him. He went up the span fiercely, cursing Fowl and cursing himself for his fear. He did not give a glance to the chasm. Staring at the gap, he ground his rage into focus and approached the shimmering tapestry of power. As he drew nearer, his ring ached on his hand. The bridge seemed to grow thinner as if it were dissolving under him. The word became starker, dominating his vision more and more. But he kept his hold on his rage. Even a leper. He reached the gap, knelt before it, looked momentarily through the shimmer at the lords. Their faces ran with sweat, and their voices trembled in their song. He clenched his hands around the staff of Baradagas and crawled into the gap. As he passed under the word, he heard an instant high keening like a whine of resistance. For that instant, a cold red flame burst from his ring. Then he was through, and the bridge and the word were still intact. He stumbled down the span, flinging off the Klingor lifeline. When he was safe, he turned long enough to see Prothol and Morum remove their staffs from under the word. Then he stalked out of the vault of Warren Bridge into the dark tunnel of the roadway. He felt Banner's presence at his shoulder almost at once, but he did not stop until the darkness against which he thrust himself was thick enough to seem impenetrable. In frustration and congested fear, he groaned, "I want to be alone. Why don't you leave me alone?" With the repressed lilt of his Harutschi inflection, Banner responded, "You are Ur-Lord Covenant. We are the Bloodguard. Your life is in our care." Covenant glared into the ineluctable dark around him and thought about the unnatural solidity of the Bloodguard. What binding principle made their flesh seem less mortal than the gut rock of Mount Thunder? A glance at his ring showed him that its incarnadine gleam had almost entirely faded. He found that he was jealous of Banner's dispassion. His own pervasive erectitude offended him. On the impulse of a ferocious intuition, he returned, "That isn't enough." He could envision Banner's slight, eloquent shrug without seeing it. In darkness, he waited defiantly until the company caught up with him. But when he was again marching in his place in the quest, when Birinair's wan flame had passed by him, treading as if transfixed by leadership the invisible directions of the roadway, the Knight of the Catacombs crowded toward him like myriad leering spectators, impatient for bloodshed, and he suffered a reaction against the strain. His shoulders began to tremble as if he had been hanging by his arms too long, and cold petrifaction settled over his thoughts. The word of warning revealed that Lord Fowl was expecting them, knew they would not fall victim to Drool's army. Drool could not have formed the word, much less made it so apposite to white gold. Therefore, it served the despiser's purposes rather than Drool's. Perhaps it was a test of some kind, a measure of the Lord's strength and resourcefulness, an indication of Covenant's vulnerability. But whatever it was Lord Fowl's doing. Covenant felt sure that the despiser knew everything, planned, arranged, made inevitable all that happened to the quest, every act and decision. Drool was ignorant, mad, manipulated. The Cave White probably failed to understand half of what he achieved under Lord Fowl's hand. But in his bones, Covenant had known such things from the beginning. They did not surprise him. Rather, he saw them as symptoms of another, a more essential threat. This central peril, a peril which so froze his mind that only his flesh seemed able to react by trembling, had to do with his white gold ring. He perceived the danger clearly because he was too numb to hide from it. The whole function of the compromise, the bargain he had made with the Runahan, was to hold the impossibility and the actuality of the land apart, in equipoise. "Back off. Let me be." To keep them from impacting into each other and blasting his precarious hold on life. But Lord Fowl was using his ring to bring, crushing together, the opposite madnesses which he needed so desperately to escape. He considered throwing the ring away, but he knew he could not do it. The band was too heavy with remembered lost love and honor and mutual respect to be tossed aside. And an old beggar. If his bargain failed, he would have nothing left with which to defend himself against the darkness. No power or fertility or coherence. Nothing but his own capacity for darkness, his violence, his ability to kill. That capacity led. He was too numb to resist the conclusion, as inalterably as leprosy, to the destruction of the land. There his numbness seemed to become complete. He could not measure his situation more than that. All he could do was trail behind Birinair's flame and tell over his refusals like some despairing acolyte, desperate for faith, trying to invoke his own autonomy. He concentrated on his footing as if it were tenuous and the rock unsure, as if Birinair might lead him over the edge of an abyss. Gradually, the character of their benighted journey changed. First, the impression of the surrounding tunnel altered. Behind the darkness, the walls seemed to open from time to time into other tunnels, and at one point the night took on an enormous depth, as if the company were passing over the floor of an amphitheater. In this blind openness, Birinair searched for his way. When the sense of vast empty space vanished, he led his companions into a stone corridor so low that his flame nearly touched the ceiling, so narrow that they had to pass in single file. Then the old heartthrall took them through a bewildering series of shifts in direction and terrain and depth. From the low tunnel they turned sharply and went down a long, steep slope with no discernible walls. As they descended, turning left and right at landmarks only Birinair seemed able to see, the black air became colder and somehow loathsome, as if it carried an echo of Irvile's. The cold came in sudden drafts and pockets, blowing through chasms and tunnels that opened unseen on either side into dens and coverts and passages and great cave-whitish halls, all invisible but for the timbre, the abrupt impression of space which they gave the darkness. Lower down, the sudden drafts began to stink. The buried air seemed to flow over centuries of accumulated filth, vast hordes of unencrypted dead, long-abandoned laboratories where banes were made. At moments, the putrescence became so thick that Covenant could see it in the air, and out of the adjacent openings came cold, distant sounds, the rattle of shale dropping into immeasurable faults, occasional low complaints of stress, soft, crystalline, chinking noises like the tap of iron hammers, muffled, sepulchral detonations, and long, tired sighs, exhalations of fatigue from the ancient foundations of the mountain. The darkness itself seemed to be muttering as the company passed. But at the end of the descent, they reached a wavering stair cut into a rock wall, with lightless, hungry chasms gaping below them. And after that, they went through winding tunnels, along the bottoms of crevices, over sharp rock ridges like arates within the mountain, around pits with the moan of water and the reek of decay in their depths, under arches like entryways to grotesque festal halls, turned and climbed and navigated in the darkness as if it were a perilous limbo, trackless and fatal, varying only in the kind and extremity of its dangers. Needing proof of his own reality, Covenant moved with the fingers of his left hand knotted in his robe over his heart. 3 times in broad, flat spaces which might have been halls or ledges or peak tops surrounded by plunges, the company stopped and ate cold food by the light of Birinair's staff. Each meal helped. The sight of other faces around the flame, the consumption of tangible provender, acted like an affirmation or a pooling of the company's capacity for endurance. Once, Quan forced himself to attempt a jest, but his voice sounded so hollow in the perpetual midnight that no one had the heart to reply. After each rest, the questers set out again bravely, and each time their pooled fortitude evaporated more rapidly, as if the darkness inhaled it with increasing voracity. Later, old Birinair led them out of cold and ventilated ways into close, musty, hot tunnels far from the main White Warrens. To reduce the risk of discovery, he chose a path through a section of the caves deader than the rest, silent and abandoned, with little fresh air left. But the atmosphere only raised the pitch of the company's tension. They moved as if they were screaming voicelessly in anticipation of some blind disaster. They went on and on, until Covenant knew only that they had not marched for days because his ring had not yet started to glow with the rising of the moon. But after a time, his white gold began to gleam like a crimson prophecy. Still they went on into what he now knew was night. They could not afford sleep or long rests. The peak of Druul's present power was only 1 day away. They were following a tunnel with walls which seemed to stand just beyond the reach of Birinair's tottering fire. Abruptly, Terrell returned from his scouting position, loomed out of the darkness to appear before the old Hirebrand. Swiftly, Prothol and Morum, with Lithe and Covenant behind them, hastened to Birinair's side. Terrell's voice held a note-like urgency as he said, "Ervile's approach. Perhaps 50. They have seen the light." Prothol groaned. Morum spat a curse. Mainthrall Lithe drew a hissing breath, whipped her cord from her hair as if she were about to encounter the stuff of which Raman nightmares were made. But before anyone could take action, old Birinair seemed to snap like a dry twig. Shouting, "Follow!" he spun to his right and raced away into the darkness. At once, two blood guards sprinted after him. For an instant, the lords hesitated. Then Prothol cried, "Melancurian!" and dashed after Birinair. Morum began shouting orders. The company sprang into battle readiness. Covenant fled after Birinair's bobbing fire. The Hirebrand's shout had not sounded like panic. That cry, "Follow!" urged Covenant along. Behind him, he heard the first commands and clatters of combat. He kept his eyes on Birinair's light, followed him into a low, nearly airless tunnel. Birinair raced down the tunnel, still a stride or two ahead of the bloodguard. Suddenly, there came a hot noise like a burst of lightning. Without warning, a sheet of blue flame enveloped the Hirebrand. Dazzling, coruscating, it walled the tunnel from top to bottom. It roared like a furnace, and Birinair hung in it, spread-limbed and transfixed, his frame contorted with agony. Beside him, his staff flared and became ash. Without hesitation, the two blood guard threw themselves at the fire. It knocked them back like blank stone. They leaped together at Birinair, trying to force him through and past the flame sheet. But they had no effect. Birinair hung where he was, a charred victim in a web of blue fire. The blood guard were poised to spring again when the High Lord caught up with them. He had to shout to make himself heard over the crackling of power. "My place," he cried, almost screaming. "He will die! Aid Morum!" He seemed to have fallen over an edge into distraction. His eyes had a look of chaos. Spreading his arms, he went forward and tried to embrace Birinair. The fire kicked him savagely away. He fell and for a long moment lay face down on the stone. Behind them, the battle mounted. The Ervile's had formed a wedge, and even with all the help of the blood guard and warriors, Morum barely held his ground. The first rush of the attack had driven the company back. Morum had retreated several yards into the tunnel where Birinair hung. There he made a stand. Despite Prothol's cries and the roar of the fire behind him, he kept his face toward the Ervile's. Heavily, Prothol raised himself. His head trembled on his tired old neck, but his eyes were no longer wild. He took a moment to recollect himself, knowing that he was already too late. Then, mustering his strength, he hurled his staff at the blue coruscation. The shod wood struck with a blinding flash. For one blank instant, Covenant could see nothing. When his vision cleared, he found the staff hanging in the sheet of flame. Birinair lay in the tunnel beyond the fire. "Birinair," the High Lord cried. "My friend!" He seemed to believe that he could help the Hirebrand if he reached him in time. Once again, he flung himself at the flame and was flung back. The Ervile's pressed their attack ferociously in hungry silence. Two of Quan's yeomen were felled as the company backed into the tunnel, and one more died now with an iron spike in his heart. A woman struck in too close to the wedge, and her hand was hacked off. Morum fought the lore master with growing desperation. Around him, the blood guard battled skillfully, but they could find few openings in the wedge. Covenant peered through the blue sheet at Birinair. The Hirebrand's face was unmarked, but it held a wide stare of agony, as if he had remained alive for one instant after his soul had been seared. The remains of his cloak hung about him in charred wisps. "Follow!" That call had not been panic. Birinair had had some idea. His shout echoed and compelled. His cloak hung about him. "Follow!" Covenant had forgotten something. Something important. Wildly, he started forward. Moram strove to strike harder. His strength played like lightning along his staff as he dealt blow after blow against the Loremaster. Weakened by its losses, the wedge began to give ground. Covenant stopped inches away from the sheet of power. Prothol's staff was suspended vertically within it like a landmark. The fire seemed to absorb rather than give off heat. Covenant felt himself growing cold and numb. In the dazzling blue force, he saw a chance for immolation, escape. Abruptly, the Urvile Loremaster gave a barking shout and broke formation. It ducked past Moram and dashed into the tunnel toward the fire, toward the kneeling High Lord. Moram's eyes flashed perilously, but he did not turn from the fight. He snapped an order to Quan and struck at the Urviles with still fiercer force. Quan leaped from the fight. He raced to unsling his bow, knock an arrow, and shoot before the Loremaster reached Prothol. Vaguely, Covenant heard the High Lord gasp against the dead air, "Urlord, beware!" But he did not listen. His wedding band burned as if the defiled moon were like the rock light on Warrenbridge, a word of warning. He reached out his left hand, hesitated momentarily, then grasped the High Lord's staff. Power surged. Bloody fire burst from his ring against the coruscating blue. The roar of the flames cycled upward beyond hearing. Then came a mighty blast, a silent explosion. The floor of the tunnel jumped as if its keel had struck a reef. The blue sheet fell in tatters. Quan was too late to save Prothol, but the Urvile did not attack the High Lord. It sprang over him toward Covenant. With all his strength, Quan bent his bow and fired at the creature's back. For an instant, Covenant stood still, listing crazily to one side and staring in horror at the abrupt darkness. Dim orange fire burned on his hand and arm, but the brilliant blue was gone. The fire gave no pain, though at first it clung to him as if he were dry wood. It was cold and empty, and it died out in sputtering flickers, as if after all he did not contain enough warmth to feed it. Then the Loremaster, with Quan's arrow squarely between its shoulders, crashed into him and scattered him across the stone. A short time later he looked up with his head full of mist. The only light in the tunnel came from Moram's Lord's fire as he drove back the Urviles. Then that light was gone too. The Urviles were routed. Tuvor and the Bloodguard started after them to prevent them from carrying reports to Drool, but Moram called, "Let them go. We are already exposed. No reports of Urviles matter now." Voices gasped and groaned in the darkness. Soon two or three of the warriors lit torches. The flames cast odd, dim shadows on the walls. The company drew together around Lord Moram and moved down to where Prothol knelt. The High Lord held Birinair's charred form in his arms, but he brushed aside the sympathy and grief of the company. "Go on," he said weakly. "Discover what he intended. I will be done with my farewells soon." In explanation, he added, "He led in my place." Moram laid a commiserating hand on the High Lord's shoulder, but the dangers of their situation did not allow him to remain still. Almost certainly Drool now knew where they were. The energies they had released would point them out like an accusing finger. Why, Moram wondered aloud, why was such power placed here? This is not Drool's doing. Carrying one of the torches, he started down the tunnel. From his collapse on the stone, Covenant replied in a grotesque, stricken voice, but he was answering a different question. "I forgot my clothes. Left them behind." Morum bent over him. Lighting his face with the torch, the Lord asked, "Are you injured? I do not understand. Of what importance are your old clothes?" The question seemed to require a world of explanation, but Covenant responded easily, glib with numbness and fog. "Of course I'm injured. My whole life is an injury." He hardly listened to his own speech. "Don't you see? When I wake up and find myself dressed in my old clothes, not this moss-stained robe at all, why, that will prove that I really have been dreaming. If it wasn't so reassuring, I would be terrified." "You have mastered a great power," Morum murmured. "That was an accident. It happened by itself. I was trying to escape. Burn myself." Then the strain overcame him. He lowered his head to the stone and went to sleep. He did not rest long. The air of the tunnel was too uncomfortable, and there was too much activity in the company. When he opened his eyes, he saw Lithe and several warriors preparing a meal over a low fire. With a trembling song on his lips and tears spilling from his eyes, Prothol was using his blue fire to sear the injured woman's wrist stump. Covenant watched as she bore the pain. Only when her wrist was tightly bandaged did she let herself faint. After that, he turned away, sick with shared pain. He lurched to his feet, reeled as if he could not find his footing, had to brace himself against the wall. He stood there hunched over his aching stomach until Morum returned, accompanied by Quan, Korik, and two other Bloodguard. The warhaft was carrying a small iron chest. When Morum reached the fire, he spoke in quiet wonder. "The power was a defense placed here by High Lord Kevin. Beyond this tunnel lies a chamber. There we found the second ward of Kevin's lore, the second of the seven." High Lord Prothol's face lit up with hope. Chapter 23, Kirill Threndor. Reverently, Prothol took the chest. His fingers fumbled at the bindings. When he raised the lid, a pale, pearly glow like clean moonlight shone from within the cask. The radiance gave his face a look of beatitude as he ventured his hand into the chest to lift out an ancient scroll. When he raised it, the company saw that it was the scroll which shone. Quan and his yeomen half knelt before the ward, bowed their heads. Morum and Prothol stood erect as if they were meeting the scrutiny of the master of their lives. After a moment of amazement, Lithe joined the warriors. Only Covenant and the Bloodguard showed no reverence. Tuvor's comrades stood casually alert, and Covenant leaned uncomfortably against the wall, trying to bring his unruly stomach under control. But he was not blind to the importance of that scroll. A private hope wrestled with his nausea. He approached it obliquely. "Did Birinair know what you were going to find? Is that why? Why he ran here?" Morum spoke absently. All of him except his voice was focused on the scroll, which Prothol held up like a mighty talisman. "Perhaps it is possible. He knew the old maps. No doubt they were given to us in the first ward so that in time we might find our way here. It may be that his heart saw what our eyes did not." Covenant paused, then asked, obliquely again, "Why did you let the Urviles escape?" This time the Lord seemed to hear his seriousness. With a piercing glance at him, Prothol replaced the scroll in the cask. When the lid was closed, Morum answered stiffly, "Unnecessary death, unbeliever. We did not come here to slay Urviles. We will harm ourselves more by unnecessary killing than by risking a few live foes. We fight in need, not in lust or rage. The oath of peace must not be compromised. But this also did not answer Covenant's question. With an effort, he brought out his hope directly. Never mind. This second ward, it doubles your power. You could send me back. Moram's face softened at the need for assurance, for consolation against impossible demands in the question. But his reply denied Covenant. Ah, my friend, you forget. We have not yet mastered the first ward, not in generations of study. The best of the Lorzrat have failed to unveil the central mysteries. We can do nothing with this new ward now. Perhaps, if we survive this quest, we will learn from the second in later years. There he stopped. His face held a look of further speech, but he said no more until Prothol sighed, "Tell him all. We can afford no illusions now." "Very well," Moram said hurriedly. "In truth, our possession of the second ward at such a time is perilous. It is clear from the first that High Lord Kevin prepared the seven in careful order. It was his purpose that the second ward remain hidden until all the first was known. Apparently, certain aspects of his lore carry great hazard to those who have not first mastered certain other aspects. So he hid his wards and defended them with powers which could not be breached until the earlier lore was mastered. Now his intent has been broken. Until we penetrate the first, we will risk much if we attempt the use of the second." He pulled himself up and took a deep breath. "We do not regret. For all our peril, this discovery may be the great moment of our age, but it may not altogether bless us." In a low voice, Prothol added, "We raise no blame or doubt. How could any have known what we would find? But the doom of the land is now doubly on our heads. If we are to defeat Lord Foul in the end, we must master powers for which we are not ready. So we learn hope and dismay from the same source. Do not mistake us. This risk we accept gladly. The mastery of Kevin's lore is the goal of our lives. But we must make clear that there is risk. I see hope for the land, but little for myself." "Even that sight is dim," said Moram tightly. "It may be that Lord Foul has led us here so that we may be betrayed by powers we cannot control." At this, Prothol looked sharply at Moram. Then slowly the High Lord nodded his agreement. But his face did not lose the relief, the lightening of its burdens, which his first sight of the ward had given him. Under its influence, he looked equal to the stewardship of his age. Now the time of High Lord Prothol, son of Dwillion, would be well remembered, if the company survived its quest. His resolve had a forward look as he closed the chest of the second ward. His movements were crisp and decisive. He gave the cask to Korik, who bound it to his bare back with strips of Klingor and covered it by knotting his tunic shut. But Covenant looked at the remains of the brief structure of his own hope, collapsed like a child's toy house, and he did not know where to turn for new edifices. He felt vaguely that he had no solid ground on which to build them. He was too weak and tired to think about it. He stood leaning where he was for a long time, with his head bent as if he were trying to decipher the chart of his robe. Despite the danger, the company rested and ate there in the tunnel. Prothol judged that remaining where they were for a time was as unpredictable as anything else they might do. So while the blood guards stood watch, he encouraged his companions to rest. Then he lay down, pillowed his head on his arms, and seemed at once to fall into deep sleep, so intensely calm and quiet that it looked more like preparation than repose. Following his example, most of the company let their eyes close, though they slept only fitfully. But Moram and Lithe remained watchful. He stared into the low fire as if he were searching for a vision, and she sat across from him with her shoulders hunched against the oppressive weight of the mountain, as unable to rest underground as if the lack of open sky and grasslands offended her Raman blood. Reclining against the wall, Covenant regarded the two of them and slept a little until the stain of his ring began to fade with moonset. After that, Prothol arose, awake and alert, and roused the company. As soon as everyone had eaten again, he put out the campfire. In its place, he lit one of the Lilianril torches. It guttered and jumped dangerously in the thick air, but he used it rather than his staff to light the tunnel. Soon the quest was marching again. Helpless to do otherwise, they left their dead lying on the stone of the ward chamber. It was the only tribute they could give Birinair and the slain warriors. Again they went into darkness, led by the High Lord through interminable, black, labyrinthian passages in the deep rock of Mount Thunder. The air became thicker, hotter, deader. In spite of occasional ascents, their main progress was downward, toward the bottomless roots of the mountain, closer with every unseen, unmeasured league toward immense, buried, slumbering, grim ills, the terrible bones of the earth. On and on they walked as if they were amazed by darkness, irremediable night. They made their way in hard silence, as if their lips were stiff with resisted sobs. They could not see. It affected them like a bereavement. As they approached the working heart of the White Warrens, certain sounds became louder, more distinct. The battering of anvils, the groaning of furnaces, gasps of anguish. From time to time they crossed blasts of hot, fetid air like forced ventilation for charnel pits. And a new noise crept into their awareness, a sound of bottomless boiling. For a long while they drew nearer to this deep moil without gaining any hint of what it was. Later, they passed its source. Their path lay along the lip of a huge cavern. The walls were lit luridly by a seething orange sea of rock light. Far below them was a lake of molten stone. After the long darkness of their trek, the bright light hurt their eyes. The rising, acrid heat of the lake snatched at them as if it were trying to pluck them from their perch. The deep, boiling sound thrummed in the air. Great gouts of magma spouted toward the ceiling, then fell back into the lake like crumbling towers. Vaguely, Covenant heard someone say, "The Demondim in the days of High Lord Lorik discarded their failed breeding efforts here. It is said that the loathing of the Demondim, and of the Vials who sired them for their own forms, surpassed all restraint. It led them to the spawning which made both Ur-Vials and Wainhim, and it drove them to cast all their weak and faulty into such pits as this. So strongly did they abhor their unseen eyelessness." Groaning, he turned his face to the wall and crept past the cavern into the passage beyond it. When he dropped his hands from the support of the stone, his fingers twitched at his sides as if he were testing the sides of a casket. Prothol chose to rest there, just beyond the cavern of rock light. The company ate a quick, cold meal, then pressed on again into darkness. From this passage they took two turns, went up a long slope, and at length found themselves walking a ledge in a fault. Its crevice fell away to their left. Covenant made his way absently, shaking his head in an effort to clear his thoughts. Ur-Vials reeled across his brain like images of self-hatred, premonitions. Was he doomed to see himself even in such creatures as that? No. He gritted his teeth. No. In the light of remembered bursts of lava, he began to fear that he had already missed his chance. His chance to fall. In time, fatigue came back over him. Prothol called a rest halt on the ledge, and Covenant surprised himself nearly falling asleep that close to a crevice. But the High Lord was pushing toward his goal now, and did not let the company rest long. With his guttering torch, he led the quest forward again, through darkness into darkness. As the trek dragged on, their moment-by-moment caution began to slip. The full of the moon was coming, and somewhere ahead, Drool was preparing for them. Prothol moved as if he were eager for the last test, and led them along the ledge at a stiff pace. As a result, the lone Ervile took them all by surprise. It had hidden itself in a thin fissure in the wall of the crevice. When Covenant passed it, it sprang out at him, threw its weight against his chest. Its roinish, eyeless face was blank with ferocity. As it struck him, it grappled for his left hand. The force of the attack knocked him backward toward the crevice. For one flicker of time, he was not aware of that danger. The Ervile consumed his attention. It pulled his hand close to its face, sniffed wetly over his fingers as if searching for something, then tried to jam his ring finger into its ragged mouth. He staggered back one more step. His foot left the ledge. In that instant, he realized the hungry fall under him. Instinctively, he closed his fist against the Ervile and ignored it. Clinging to his staff with all the strength of his half-hand, he thrust its end toward Banner. The blood guard was already reaching for him. Banner caught hold of the staff. For one slivered moment, Covenant kept his grip. But the full weight of the Ervile hung on his left arm. His hold tore loose from the staff. With the creature struggling to bite off his ring, he plunged into the crevice. Before he could shriek his terror, a force like a boulder struck him, knocked the air from his lungs, left him gasping sickly as he plummeted. With his chest constricted and retching, unable to cry out, he lost consciousness. When he roused himself after the impact, he was struggling for air against a face full of dirt. He lay head down on a steep slope of shale and loam and refuse, and the slide caused by his landing had covered his face. For a long moment, he could not move except to gag and cough. His efforts shook him without freeing him. Then, with a shuddering exertion, he rolled over, thrust up his head. He coughed up a gout of dirt and found that he could breathe, but he still could not see. The fact took a moment to penetrate his awareness. He checked his face, found that his eyes were uncovered and open, but they perceived nothing except an utter and desolate darkness. It was as if he were blind with panic, as if his optic nerves were numb with terror. For a time, he did panic. Without sight, he felt the empty air suck at him as if he were drowning in quicksand. The night beat about him on naked wings like vultures dropping toward dead meat. His heart beat out heavy jolts of fear. He cowered there on his knees, abandoned, bereft of eyes and light and mind by the extremity of his dread, and his breath whimpered in his throat. But as the first rush of his panic passed, he recognized it. Fear. It was an emotion he understood, a part of the condition of his existence, and his heart went on beating, lurching as if wounded. It still kept up his life. Suddenly, convulsively, he raised his fists and struck at the shale on either side of his head, pounded to the rhythm of his pulse as if he were trying to beat rationality out of the dirt. No. No. I am going to survive. The assertion steadied him. Survive. He was a leper, accustomed to fear. He knew how to deal with it. Discipline. Discipline. He pressed his hands over his eyeballs. Spots of color jerked across the black. He was not blind. He was seeing darkness. He had fallen away from the only light in the catacombs. Of course he could not see. Hell and blood. Instinctively, he rubbed his hands, winced at the bruises he had given himself. Discipline. He was alone. Alone. Lightless somewhere on the bottom of a ledge of the crevice long leagues from the nearest open sky. Without help, friends, rescue, for him the outside of the mountain was as unattainable as if it had ceased to exist. Escape itself was unattainable Unless discipline. Unless he found some way to die. Hellfire. Thirst. Hunger. Injury. Loss of blood. He iterated the possibilities as if he were going through a VSE. He might fall prey to some dark bred bane, might stumble over a more fatal precipice. Madness, yes. It would be as easy as leprosy. Midnight wings beat about his ears, reeled vertiginously across the blind blackscape. His hands groped unconsciously around his head, seeking some way to defend himself. Damnation. None of this is happening to me. Discipline. A fetal fancy came over him. He caught hold of it as if it were a vision. Yes. Quickly he changed his position so that he was sitting on the shale slope. He fumbled over his belt until he found Atiyarin's knife. Poising it carefully in his half-fingerless grip, he began to shave. Without water or a mirror, he was perilously close to slitting his throat, and the dryness of his beard caused him pain as if he were using the knife to dredge his face into a new shape. But this risk, this pain, was part of him. There was nothing impossible about it. If he cut himself, the dirt on his skin would make infection almost instantaneous. It calmed him like a demonstration of his identity. In that way, he made the darkness draw back, withhold its talons. When he was done, he mustered his resolution for an exploration of his situation. He wanted to know what kind of place he was in. Carefully, tentatively, he began searching away from the slopes on his hands and knees. Before he had moved 3 feet across flat stone, he found a body. The flesh yielded as if it had not been dead long, but its chest was cold and slick, and his hand came back wet, smelling of rotten blood. He recoiled to the slope, gritted himself into motionlessness while his lungs heaved loudly and his knees trembled. The Urvile that had attacked him, broken by the fall. He wanted to move, but could not. The shock of discovery froze him like a sudden opening of dangerous doors. He felt surrounded by perils which he could not name. How had that creature known to attack him? Could it actually smell white gold? Then his ring began to gleam. The bloody radiation transformed it into a band of dull fire about his wedding finger, a crimson fetter. But it shed no light, did not even enable him to see the digit on which it hung. It shone balefully in front of him, exposed him to any eyes that were hidden in the dark, but it gave him nothing but dread. He could not forget what it meant. Drool's bloody moon was rising full over the land. It made him quail against the shale slope. He had a gagging sensation in his throat, as if he were being force-fed terror. Even the uncontrollable wheeze of his respiration seemed to mark him for attack by claws and fangs so invisible in the darkness that he could not visualize them. He was alone, helpless, abject. Unless he found some way to make use of the power of his ring. He fell back in revulsion from that thought the instant it crossed his mind. No, never. He was a leper. His capacity for survival depended on a complete recognition, acceptance of his essential impotence. That was the law of leprosy. Nothing could be as fatal to him. Nothing could destroy him, body and mind, as painfully as the illusion of power. Power in a dream. And before he died, he would become as fetid and deformed as that man he had met in the leprosarium. No. Better to kill himself outright. Anything would be better. He did not know how long he spun giddily before he heard a low noise in the darkness, distant, slippery, and ominous, as if the surrounding midnight had begun breathing softly through its teeth. It stunned him like a blow to the heart. Flinching in blind fear, he tried to fend it off. Slowly, it grew clearer, a quiet, susurrous sound like a gridded exhalation from many throats. It infested the air like vermin, made his flesh crawl. They were coming for him. They knew where he was because of his ring, and they were coming for him. He had a quick vision of a way in him with an iron spike through its chest. He clapped his right hand over his ring, but he knew that was futile as soon as he did it. Frenetically, he began searching over the shale for some kind of weapon. Then he remembered his knife. It felt too weightless to help him, but he gripped it and went on hunting with his right hand, hardly knowing what he sought. For a long moment, he fumbled around him, regardless of the noise he made. Then his fingers found his staff. Banner must have dropped it, and it had fallen near him. The susurration drew nearer. It was the sound of many bare feet sliding over stone. They were coming for him. The staff. It was a higher brand's staff. Baradakis had given it to him. In the hour of darkness, remember the higher brand's staff. If he could light it. But how? The black air loomed with enemies. Their steps seemed to slide toward him from above. How? He cried desperately, trying to make the staff catch fire by sheer force of will. Baradakis! Still the feet came closer. He could hear hoarse breathing behind their sibilant approach. It had burned for him at the celebration of spring. Shaking with haste, he pressed the end of the staff to his blood-embered ring. At once, red flame blossomed on the wood, turned pale orange and yellow, flared up brightly. The sudden light dazzled him, but he leaped to his feet and held the staff over his head. He was standing at the bottom of a long slope which filled half the floor of the crevice. This loose piled shale had saved his life by giving under the impact of his fall, rolling him down instead of holding him where he hit. Before and behind him, the crevice stretched upward far beyond the reach of his flame. Nearby, the Urvile lay twisted on its back, its black skin wet with blood. Shuffling purposefully toward him along the crevice floor was a disjointed company of cave whites. They were still 30 yards away, but even at that distance he was surprised by their appearance. They did not look like other cave whites he had seen. The difference was not only in costume, though these creatures were ornately and garishly caparisoned like a royal cadre, elite and obscene. They were physically different. They were old. Old prematurely, unnaturally. Their red eyes were hooded, and their long limbs bent as if the bones had been warped in a short time. Their heads sagged on necks that still looked thick enough to be strong and erect. Their heavy, spatulate hands trembled as if with palsy. Together they reeked of ill, of victimization. But they came forward with clenched determination, as if they had been promised the peace of death when this last task was done. Shaking off his surprise, he brandished his staff threateningly. "Don't touch me," he hissed through his teeth. "Back off. I made a bargain." The cave whites gave no sign that they had heard, but they did not attack him. When they were almost within his reach, they spread out on both sides, awkwardly encircled him. Then, by giving way on one side and closing toward him on the other, they herded him in the direction from which they had come. As soon as he understood that they wished to take him someplace without a fight, he began to cooperate. He knew intuitively where they were going. So through their tortuous herding, he moved slowly along the crevice until he reached a stair in the left wall. It was a rude way, roughly hacked out of the rock, but it was wide enough for several cave whites to climb abreast. He was able to control his vertigo by staying near the wall, away from the crevice. They ascended for several hundred feet before they reached an opening in the wall. Though the stairs continued upward, the cave whites steered him through this opening. He found himself in a narrow tunnel with a glow of rock light at its end. The creatures marched him more briskly now, as if they were hurrying him toward a scaffold. Then a wash of heat and a stink of brimstone poured over him. He stepped out of the tunnel into Kiru Threndor. He recognized the burnished stone gleam of the faceted walls, the fetid stench like sulfur consuming rotten flesh, the several entrances, the burning dance of light on the clustered stalactites high overhead. It was all as vivid to him as if it had just been translated from a nightmare. The cave whites ushered him into the chamber, then stood behind him to block the entrance. For the second time, he met Drool Rockworm. Drool crouched on his low dais in the center of the cave. He clenched the Staff of Law in both his huge hands, and it was by the staff that Covenant first recognized him. Drool had changed. Some blight had fallen on him. As he caught sight of Covenant, he began laughing shrilly. But his voice was weak, and his laughter had a pitch of hysteria. He did not laugh long. He seemed too exhausted to sustain it. Like the cave whites who had herded Covenant, he was old. But whatever had damaged them had hurt him more. His limbs were so gnarled that he could hardly stand. Saliva ran uncontrolled from his drooping lips, and he was sweating profusely, as if he could no longer endure the heat of his own domain. He gripped the staff in an attitude of fierce possessiveness and desperation. Only his eyes had not changed. They shone redly, without iris or pupil, and seemed to froth like malicious lava, eager to devour. Covenant felt a strange mixture of pity and loathing. But he had only a moment to wonder what had happened to Drool. Then he had to brace himself. The cave white began hobbling painfully toward him. Groaning at the ache in his limbs, Drool stopped a few paces from Covenant. He released one hand from the intricately runed staff to point a trembling finger at Covenant's wedding band. When he spoke, he cast continual, twitching leers back over his shoulder, as if referring to an invisible spectator. His voice was as gnarled and racked as his arms and legs.
"Mine," he coughed. "You promised. Mine. Lord Drool, staff and ring. You promised. Do this, you said. Do that. Do not crush. Wait now."
He spat viciously.
"Kill later. You promised. The ring, if I did what you said. You said."
He sounded like a sick child.
"Drool. Lord Drool. Power. Mine now."
Slavering thickly, he reached a hand for Covenant's ring. Covenant reacted in instant revulsion. With his burning staff, he struck a swift blow, slapped Drool's hand away. At the impact, his staff broke into slivers as if Drool's flesh were vehement iron. But Drool gave a coughing roar of rage and stamped the heel of the Staff of Law on the floor. The stone jumped under Covenant's feet. He pitched backward, landed with a jolt that seemed to stop his heart. He lay stunned and helpless. Through a throbbing noise in his ears, he heard Drool cry,
"Slay him! Give the ring!"
He rolled over. Sweat blurred his vision. Blearily, he saw the cave whites converging toward him. His heart felt paralyzed in his chest, and he could not get his feet under him. Retching for air, he tried to crawl out of reach. The first cave white caught hold of his neck, then abruptly groaned and fell away to the side. Another cave white fell. The rest drew back in confusion. One of them cried fearfully,
"Bloodguard! Lord Drool, help us!"
"Fool!"
retorted Drool, coughing as if his lungs were in shreds.
"Coward! I am power. Slay them."
Covenant climbed to his feet, wiped the sweat from his eyes, and found Banner standing beside him. The Blood Guard's robe hung tattered from his shoulders, and a large bruise on his brow closed one eye. But his hands were poised, alert. He carried himself on the balls of his feet, ready to leap in any direction. His flat eyes held a dull gleam of battle. Covenant felt such a surge of relief that he wanted to hug Banner. After his long, lightless ordeal, he felt suddenly rescued, almost redeemed. But his gruff voice belied his emotion.
"What the hell took you so long?"
The Cave Whites came forward slowly, timorously, and surrounded Covenant and Banner. Drool raged at them in hoarse gasps. Overhead, the chiaroscuro of the stalactites danced gaily. With startling casualness, Banner replied that he had landed badly after killing the Ervile and had lost consciousness. Then he had been unable to locate Covenant in the darkness. Lashed by Drool's strident commands, a Cave White charged Covenant from behind. But Banner spun easily, felled the creature with a kick. "The flame of your staff revealed you," he continued. "I chose to follow." He paused to spring at two of the nearest attackers. They retreated hastily. When he spoke again, his foreign Harutschi tone held a note of final honesty. "I withheld my aid, awaiting proof that you are not a foe of the Lord's." Something in the selfless and casual face that Banner turned toward death communicated itself to Covenant. He answered without rancor, "You picked a fine time to test me." "The Blood Guard, no doubt. We require to be sure." Drool mustered his strength to shriek furiously,
"Fools! Worms! Afraid of only two!"
He spat.
"Go! Watch! Lord Drool kills!"
The Cave Whites gave way, and Drool came wincing forward. He held the Staff of Law before him like an axe. Banner leaped, launched a kick at Drool's face. But for all his crippled condition, Drool Rockworm was full of power. He did not appear to feel Banner's attack. In ponderous fury, he raised the staff to deal a blast which would incinerate Banner and Covenant where they stood. Against the kind of might he wielded, they were helpless. Still, Banner braced himself in front of Covenant to meet the blow. Flinching, Covenant waited for the pain that would set him free. But Drool was already too late. He had missed his chance, neglected other dangers. Even as he raised the staff, the company of the quest, led by First Mark Tuvor and High Lord Prothol, broke into Kirill Threndor. They looked battered, as if they had just finished a skirmish with Drool's outer defenses, but they were whole and dour-handed, and they entered the chamber like a decisive wave. Prothol stopped Drool's blast with a shout full of authority. Before the Cave Whites could gather themselves together, the yeomen fell on them, drove them from the cave. In a moment, Drool was surrounded by a wide ring of warriors and blood guard. Slowly, with an appearance of confusion, he retreated until he was half crouching on his dais. He looked around the circle as if unable to realize what had happened, but his spatulate hands held the staff in a grip as grim as death. Then, grotesquely, his Laval eyes took on an angle of cunning. Twitching nods over his shoulder, he hissed in a raw voice, "Here,
this is fair. Fair, better than promises. All of them here. All little lords and puny blood guard. Humans, ready for crushing."
He started to laugh, broke into a fit of coughing.
"Crush,"
he spat when he regained control of himself.
"Crush with power."
He made a noise like a cracking of bones in his throat.
"Power, little lords, mighty Drool, better than promises."
Prothol faced the Cave White squarely. Giving his staff to Morum, he stepped forward to the dais with Tuvor at his side. He stood erect. His countenance was calm and clear.